You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
And, of course, your co-host, Paul Luzon. This is Garcia. You're listening to the American Hour. Welcome tonight. We've got a great show. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday night. We rescheduled from Wednesday, Thursday to Tuesday, Wednesday to accommodate some things. There's a lot of stuff going on in the news. But in any case, my lovely co-host, Paul Luzon, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great, Tom. It's a clear 40 degrees here in the greater Boston area, and we're waiting for the messy weather to come within the next 2 days, starting sometime tomorrow.
Okay. Well, of course, you know, I'm sitting on my patio broadcasting because it's just too nice to do that. And I'm actually a little bit sweaty. It's 80 degrees. And it's because there's not much wind right now. I'm looking at the palm trees, and they're not swaying much, so there's not much of a breeze out here, so... I was thinking about putting the ceiling fan on, but in any case, yeah, I mean, it is what it is. So, yeah, a lot of stuff going on, and it's a tight race in Arizona and Michigan with Rick Santorum, of course, the guy I support, and Mitt Romney. And, Paula, you sent me a link to an email, you sent me an email with a link to an article about Mitt Romney saying that he made some mistakes.
Yes.
Michigan, which is his home turf, what kind of mistakes did he make?
Well, in the New York Times this evening, Romney confronted by polls showing him in danger of losing his home state of Michigan in Tuesday's Republican primary, accepted personal blame for his inability to emerge as the decisive favorite in his party's nomination fight, but said that he was unwilling to light my hair on fire to win. After a bruising week in which he drew unwanted attention to his wealth, by declaring that his wife owned not one but two Cadillacs and that he was friends with NASCAR team owners, Mr. Romney said he has made some mistakes in acknowledging that those off-the-cuff comments had damaged his campaign. He said he was determined to correct course as he prepared for a dozen crucial contests on March 6th, which is Super Tuesday. As Republicans across Michigan headed to the polls, the race there took a volatile new turn with his admission from Rick Santorum's campaign that it had begun urging Democratic voters to turn out at the polls on Tuesday and vote against Mr. Romney. In automated calls to Democrats, Santorum's campaign declared Romney supported the bailouts for his Wall Street billionaire buddies but opposed the auto bailouts. That was a slap in the face to every Michigan worker, and we're not going to let Romney get away with it. The unusual tactic relying on Democratic voters in a Republican primary drew an angry rebuke from Mr. Romney. He called it a dirty trick in a television interview and returned to the topic during a press conference with reporters. Arizona also held its Republican primary today, and Mr. Romney was comfortably ahead in polls there in the days before the vote. In Michigan, though, new electoral rules allow independent and Democratic voters to request a Republican ballot, and the result is a primary that is effectively open to Democratic or independent game playing. Mr. Santorum defended the tactic on Laura Ingraham's radio show today, saying that Romney had used such robocalls this year featuring Santorum's endorsement of Romney in 08. Mr. Santorum spent Tuesday afternoon campaigning in Ohio, which holds its contest on Super Tuesday next week, and he tied Romney's Massachusetts health care initiative to President Obama's health care overhaul, warning that Obamacare represents a very dangerous turning point in America.
Wow. Well, yeah. And again, I support Rick Santorum full-heartedly and hope he wins this and pulls it off, because he's the right guy, in my belief, to go up against Obama. But with that said, I've got to tell you, I've been getting emails. There's a post on the Facebook page. Of course, if you want to follow us on Facebook, go to the American Hour Radio Show. And, of course, you can also follow us on Twitter. And I'm going to give you some of our Twitter feed information here. Paula, we're almost up to the 4,500 mark of followers of the American Hour Radio Show. Not bad, huh? We'll get there one day. We'll have 100,000.
There you go.
Anyway, this is the kind of stuff. A couple different people sent me this stuff. And I'm just going to read the first one. This is right off of our Facebook page. And I didn't go into great detail as a rebuttal, not to be a rebuttal. And again, I support Santorum, not Romney. But we have to understand, if Romney does get the nomination, we're going to get behind him 1,000%. We just don't think he's the best guy. Not necessarily the right guy. He's not the best guy, my estimating. Now, with that said, remember, and just pay attention to where I'm going with this. Romney is a Mormon. Santorum is a Catholic. Romney is not the most electable candidate. Now, this is, again, was posted on our Facebook page yesterday. The Democratic Party and their surrogates will destroy him and Mormons. Well, first of all, you know what? If you want to go after Mormons, the party and your surrogates, and you just sit back and let it happen, you're all scumbags. You're all scumbags. But anyways, it has already started by the New York Times. He's magic underwear. You know what? That guy is a scumbag. In fact, he is one of those stains you see on the sidewalk left behind by a dog that somebody didn't clean up or whatever. That's what that guy is. Mormonism is a cult started by Joseph Smith Jr. in the 1830s. They claim to be the true revealed Christianity. One of the Mormon teachings is we are incarnated children of God and one of his many heavenly, and in other words, God and one of his many heavenly wives. Now, with that said, I'm going to give everybody a disclaimer here. I was born and raised into a Mormon family and spent the majority of my life as a Mormon. I am not a practicing Mormon now. But these kind of statements are outright untruths. And I don't want to, you know, impugn somebody that's been following the American Hour and that kind of thing. But there's a lot of falsehoods out there, and people read stuff. I'm telling you right now, from somebody that's there, I've been in Mormon temples many, many times. Everything that you think you know about the Mormon church is a bunch of baloney. First of all, this thing that Mormon teaches is we are incarnated children of God. Well, we believe that we are children of God. We were spirit beings, just like most churches believe. But there's nothing in Mormon religion, nothing, zero, Paula. I grew up in the church that says that God and one of his many heavenly wives produced us. That's the kind of bullcrap that comes out about the Mormon church. So, with that said, here's what I had to say as a rebuttal. Not about trying to defend the Mormon church, which I really don't think needs any defense whatsoever. You can talk about, oh, Joseph Smith and where the Mormon church come from. I'll tell you what. Look at Mormons today. They're some of the best, most wonderful people in society, and I will tell you this as an absolute fact. The Mormon church teaches its members, whether you're in Soviet, communist Russia, or communist China, you do not take up arms against your government. You work within the system. If it's not a good system, to change. But you never, ever take up arms against your country. So, let's talk about O'Bumbler and his religion. Black liberation theology. He went to a church for 20 years that taught black liberation theology, and Jeremiah Wright came on Fox Hannity show and said, "You don't know anything about black liberation theology." He didn't deny that it's black liberation theology. But here's one of Jeremiah Wright's statements. Jesus was a poor black man. Interesting. Huh. I thought he was Jewish. And Jews typically aren't black. But whatever. James Cone, the chief architect of black liberation theology, he's the one who really got it started. Black liberation theology was stolen from liberation theology, which was started in the Caribbean and Latin America. And I'll explain in a moment why it was, but black liberation theology, according to James Cone, the author of Black Liberation Theology, which Jeremiah Wright is a follower and a theologian of James Cone, white Americans do not have the ability to recognize the humanity in persons of color. Oh, well, thank you, James Cone, for telling me that I can't recognize the humanity in my friends that are persons of color. Well, you're a turd as well. Black liberation theology is Marxist victimology. It's Marxist victimology. So it's based on Marxism, but it's also victimology. And in fact, what it teaches people of color to do is to be victims. So the reality is this. All of you people that are worried, if Romney gets the nomination and his surrogates, Obama's surrogates and everybody else starts going after Mormonism, he has just opened the door to take a very, very close look at black liberation theology, where a church that he went to for 20 years, which quite frankly, and I'm a Mormon, not anymore, but I'm somebody who grew up in the Mormon church and felt some persecution for my beliefs. I'm very, very cautious about going after any other religion out there. Very, very cautious. But when I read the book by James Cone on black liberation theology, here's the essence of black liberation theology. Whitey owes us. And if you want salvation and you're white, even though you never had any slaves and you had nothing to do with any of that in the past, you need to basically give everything you have to the black people. Just give it all up and become poor and or a slave to make up for what was done to us in the past. That's the whole core of black liberation theology. It's Marxism tied to an absolute distortion of Christianity to try and take poor people from one particular sect or one particular demographic and get them to rise up and take over and take from others. Others that have done nothing at all whatsoever to harm them. So it disgusts me, the kind of church that Obama went to, but if you look at what the Mormon church stands for today, it stands for family values, and they're some of the best citizens that exist in this country today. So there you have it. I just wanted, because this, you know, thing that's going on, and I've been getting emails about it, and we got a post on the website, I just wanted to bring that up. A lot of what you know about Mormonism, you tell me, you quote me from one of the prophets, the Mormon prophets, or from their scripture that says that we are all children of God, not Jesus, but God, and one of his many wives. There's nowhere. I've read every single scripture many, many times when I was younger, and there's nothing in there about that. But I just quoted directly out of James Cone's book, Black Liberation Theology, a quote that is very, very racist, very racist. So, time to move on to much more important stuff. And Jeff Sessions today had a quote on the economy, and it's at the website. If you want to find out more about this information, it's at budget.senate.gov/Republican. This is their essentially rebuttal to the Obama budget, and we're going to get into it a little bit more. We're going to get into it right now. The defense budget is taking the biggest hit, Paula, the biggest hit. Now, to the average American, well, you know, we had a couple wars going on, and, you know, well, what can we say? There's a lot of money being spent there. Well, first of all, the defense budget that's in the annual budget does not include our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Those are called off-budget. That's not to say that we're not spending money. Well, in fact, we're not spending money because we don't have money to spend because it's not in the budget. We're just printing money to pay for those wars. Now, before you libtards call in and go, oh, Tom, what about Bush, blah, 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 why do you assume that I agreed with Bush's policies? I was absolutely against trying to nation build in Afghanistan or Iraq. But the current president said that the real war to fight on terror is right in Afghanistan, and he's completely bungled that. Look what's going on today. The Afghanistan people hate us. They want us out. We want out. And where are we? Nowhere. The Taliban are just going to swoop right back in and take right back over. Absolute mistake to stay there. We should have gone in and bombed the holy hell out of them and killed all the Taliban like we did and then just simply left. But no, we got to stick around and nation build. Well, whose fault was that? Well, that was George Bush's fault. I'm not disagreeing with that. You want to call in and complain about George Bush? You're not going to find any disagreements from me, so stop wasting your time. But how does that somehow make this president's actions okay? It doesn't. One wrong doesn't condone another wrong. So don't try and paint me as some George Bush, promoter, and I was all behind him. And, you know, well, Tom, back then, why didn't you say anything about it? Well, first of all, I didn't have a radio show. If I did, I would have been saying it every single night. This is wrong. We shouldn't be doing this. And here you go. There's the result of it. But we've got a president who has continued the failed policies of another president in Afghanistan. And what's it gotten us? Nothing but freaking hatred. So go in, blow the hell out of people, and get the hell out. But anyway, the president's budget fails the pledge that the president made on February 23rd, 2009, at his fiscal responsibility summit. Fiscal responsibility, Paula. Here's what he said. And that's why today I'm pledging to cut the deficit we inherited in half by the end of my first term in office. It doesn't even come close to that. But I know that we've got the soundbite for that. So let me play that.
And that's why today I'm pledging to cut the deficit we inherited by half by the end of my first term in office.
Well, he failed at that, but now he's got an excuse. Oh, we had no idea it was that bad. Well, we've already talked about this on the show before. He made statements back in 2008 before he even got elected. This is the worst crisis since the Great Depression. Oh, but then it turned out to be even worse than that? Well, the guy's an absolute incompetent. Anyway, the budget does absolutely nothing to change the unsustainable trend of spending and growth of the debt. Now, here's what the president's claimed deficit reduction is based on, the following deceptions. And this is, again, off of the budget.senate.gov website. It does not count the cost of replacing the $1.2 trillion sequester required under law. Now, I'm going to explain what that was. Remember, Paula, when we were trying to come to an agreement on raising the deficit or the debt ceiling, not the annual deficit, but the total debt ceiling. Oh, we're going to hit the debt ceiling, and we're just not going to have any more money. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, that was last year. So the deal was, all right, we're going to make some cuts. No, we're going to extend it. But they couldn't come up with any kind of cuts so that we wouldn't bump up against that again. So they created a super committee. And remember, the deal was, if the super committee can't come to an agreement, which it didn't, then we're going to have automatic cuts. And one of those automatic cuts was $500 billion out of the military. Well, the president now is saying, well, we're not going to honor that. What we're going to do is just raise taxes. So the $1.2 trillion sequester, which included $500 billion in cuts of the military bore the brunt of all of the cuts. And this is important because we're going to come back to this theme. The military bore and will bear the brunt of the majority of the cuts. The 1.2 million required cuts, the president is now saying, not going to do it. We're not going to follow the law. We're just going to raise taxes such that we can raise $1 trillion to pay for it. Well, what does that ultimately mean? It means we're not cutting any debt. Debt's going to only grow. Government spending's going to continue as it has. We're just going to raise taxes to cover it. But the law says we've got to cut spending. So you remember, it was a big argument, Paula. Got to cut spending, got to cut spending. And the president agreed, oh, we got to cut spending, got to cut spending. Now he's saying, we don't have to cut spending. We're just going to raise taxes. Okay, so that's the first deception in his spending bill, is they're just not going to adhere to the $1.2 trillion cut. It counts the inevitable winding down of the war costs in Afghanistan, all of which is borrowed, as a $1 trillion spending reduction. Now, as I mentioned earlier, all of the war spending is off budget. Paula, that's like saying you got a budget. You know, you got X amount of money coming in, X amount of money going out to pay for, you know, mortgage, rent, food, you know, car expenses, et cetera. But then you've got some other expenses. And who knows what those expenses are. But in this case, we'll just, you know, make it, I go to Walmart and Target every day and I buy stuff. But that's not counted in my budget. Where is it counted? Well, it's in a super secret credit card that one day I might have to pay off, or I can just try and ignore or default on it, whatever. I mean, that's what it is. All of that war spending is not on the budget. But there's no money coming in to pay for it either. So it's not money that we're spending. It's just further debt that we're going into. But the president is saying since we're not going into further debt, in other words, we're going to start printing less money. Oh, we just save money. But it's not on the budget. It's off the budget. So we're not saving money in the actual budget. It buries $522 billion cost of freezing the Medicare physician update in the baseline without identifying any sources for paying for it. In other words, Medicare is supposed to freeze. Payments and increases for Medicare are supposed to freeze, worth $522 billion. But there's no way to pay for it. And it's going to go up. The government will have to. Otherwise, you're going to find millions of seniors that will not be able to get their Medicare, health care taken care of. They won't be able to bill it to Medicare. So it will get paid for. But the problem is they're ignoring it. They're going like, oh, it doesn't exist. But it's going to come back to get us. So that's $500 billion right there. A comparison of the president's math and honest math is shown below. And if you go to the website, you'll see the chart. And honest accounting shows that the president only reduces the deficit. And we're talking the annual deficit, not the debt, but the annual deficit. How far we're going into debt each year? By $273 billion, and that's over 10 years. By his own estimates, increases the gross debt by approximately $11 trillion on top of the $5 trillion that he's already accumulated in the first 3 years of office. So we're talking $16 trillion more of debt going on the backs of our children with virtually no reduction in annual deficit and no, absolutely no. See, if you say reduction in annual deficit, well, it doesn't eliminate the annual deficit. There still will be an annual, we will still be going into debt each year, and it will be a much greater amount than what the president is projecting because he uses the deceptive smoke and mirror tactics. So in reality, by 2020, we're going to be about 20, as a nation, $25 trillion in debt. And the government will be bigger than ever before. Now, I'm going to refer to, now that we've talked about sort of the budget and the money and everything, let's talk about something that's important when it comes to cutting costs. The president has aggressively gone after cutting the Defense Department. Now, on CNN, you've probably seen him, Paula, Fareed Zakaria. Of course, I used a Spanish accent. He's not Spanish whatsoever. He's something else, Middle Eastern or something. I don't know. Fareed Zakaria. There you go. Well, he wrote an article back in August of 2010 that said, cut the defense. Yeah, cut it. Now, well, let's just go straight to his article. If the Congressional Super Commission cannot agree on ways to reduce the debt by about $1.5 trillion over 10 years, then pull the trigger. And half those cuts automatically come from national security. I say let the guillotine fall. It's about time. Well, I say, Fareed, you are an absolute moron. You're a dumbass and a moron, and I'm going to explain exactly why. Because he goes on to say that in the last 13 years that the Defense Department spending has risen 70%. 70%. Wow. Okay, Paul. Well, here we go. In 2008, it was before Barack Obama took over as President of the United States, defense spending was 22% of the total budget. Do you know what it is today? It's 19%. Oh, that's a drop of 3%. The executive branch, all those bureaucracies that create regulations, all the spending that the president gets to do when it comes to whether it be TARP or stimulus, Solyndra, on and on and on, went from 27% of the budget, it's now 37% of the budget. So when Fareed Frico Zakaria says that the Defense Department has grown by 30% over the last 13 years. I remember at least 15 years ago, Paula, when the executive branch was smaller than the Defense Department, than the budgetary requirements for the Defense Department. So let's see. If it's gone up 37% since 2008, and let's go back 13 years now, and it was significantly smaller in the military, let's see, by my calculation, the executive branch has grown by 150%. And let me explain how I come to those numbers. Well, 13 years ago, the Defense Department would have been around $500 billion, somewhere around that. And the executive branch was down in the $400 billion range. How much goes to the executive branch today? $1.3 trillion. Now, in his article, he said about $700 billion. Last year, it was actually $670 billion. So not about $700 billion. How about $6.5 billion? That's a little bit closer. But in any case, the executive branch, the government, has grown 150% in the last 15 or 13 years, Fareed. Wow, how come you're not upset about that? How come? Well, that's because the libtards love government. They love government because they want to control you. They can control you with the government, but they can't control you with the military. Unless we had a different kind of government. Yeah, in Nazi Germany, yeah, they can control you with the military, maybe. Libtards hate the military because those of us that have served in the military, we all swear an oath to defend the Constitution. And libtards hate the Constitution because it stops them from controlling us. It stops government from controlling us. People all over the place, I run into them all the time, believe that the Constitution is outdated. Well, why do they think it's outdated? I ask them, why? Well, you know, it was written 200 years ago. So then I ask them, well, when were the Ten Commandments written? 3,000 years ago? Yeah, are the Ten Commandments outdated? Well, no. Well, why aren't they outdated? Because the Ten Commandments were written to protect us from human nature, our own human nature. Well, what's the Constitution written to do? Protect us from our own human nature. Government exceeding its powers. Government exceeding the power of the people. If you look at the Constitution, Paula, the bulk of the Constitution shackles the federal government. I mean, look at the entire Constitution. Before you get to any amendments, and the first 10 amendments are called the Bill of Rights, all of those right. tell us precisely what the structure of the government is, and unlike President Obama in 2001 when he said that the Constitution tells us what the government can't do to you, the Constitution doesn't tell us anything about what the government can't do to us. It tells us precisely what power the government has. It tells us precisely what power the government has. It doesn't say anything about what the government can't do. It does, in some cases, tell us what the states can't do. Minimal. Very minimal. But the rest of it is all centered around, here's what the government has for power. But, big but, no more. This is all that government can do. That's what it does. It shackles government. It protects us from human nature. But libtards can't stand that. And here's the problem. So they go, well, Tom, you're right about that. It does protect us from the government, but I want government to do more for me. Well, what do you want? I want a guaranteed house. I want a guaranteed job. I want controls on the market. I want controls on big, bad, evil corporations. I want control on free enterprise. Oh, so you want Soviet Constitution because it guaranteed all those things. Remember, Paula, a week or two ago we did a show on the Soviet Constitution?
Yes.
It's utopian. Oh, my gosh, it guarantees all those things. The problem
right.
is what libtards don't understand, what they want so badly, what they want so, so badly is to control everything in you and me and everything we do. But in order to get that, you have to give up all liberty. The government can't guarantee you a house unless it controls the housing market. The government can't guarantee you a job unless it controls every industry that is out there. And once they control all of those things, guess what? Now they don't have to give you any of it because they control it all. Or they say they'll give it to you. You know, Paula, what if they said came to you and said, yeah, we got a guaranteed job for you. You're going to be working in a coal mine. There are plenty of people that work in coal mines, and that's an honorable profession. You might not want to. I don't want to. But that's what the government will say. We guarantee you a job. You're just going to have to do the job we tell you. You have to give up all of your liberty. to get these things. But libtards just refuse to understand this. So that's why I tell them, go move to Venezuela, go move to Cuba, go move to China. You'll get all of the guarantees that you want. You're not going to have the life you want, but you'll get all the guarantees that you want. And that's the problem with this stuff. Now, as we move along, talking about the economy and this libtard at CNN that says, yeah, cut the Defense Department. Let's see what's actually going on with the Defense Department cuts. In the spirit of Obama's pledge to boost funding for clean energy initiatives, the budget, his budget, provides an overall boost to the Department of Education, increasing its budget 12% from 2010 levels to $29.5 billion. Now, Paula, for a couple of years now, I've been telling people, do you have any idea what the budget of the Department of Energy is? And they look at me and go, oh, I don't know. It's $25 billion. Do you know what the budget for NASA is? It's only $19 billion. Now, how could the Department of Energy be more important than NASA? Well, it isn't. It's absolutely not important at all to anything that we do. But we're going to increase this budget while we slash NASA's budget. Now, I'm going somewhere with this, Paula, that is going to take us to veterans, because that's near and dear to both of us.
Definitely.
We're going to see what a slime that this president actually is. And I say the word slime affectionately, because we just watched Ghostbusters 2 last night, and there's a lot of slime in it, a lot of slime. In any case, well, let's take a look at the Department of Energy's mission, because, I mean, you know, we know what the mission of the military is, to protect us, secure our nation, and take on enemies abroad and make sure that the war never comes to us and all that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, it's important stuff. Let's see what the Department of Energy's mission is. You know, when Carter asked to create a Department of Energy, he said, the goal of the Department of Energy is to reduce our dependence on foreign energy sources, meaning oil. And how has the Department of Energy done in that regard since 1970? Or 73, I think, is when he did it. They've utterly failed. But now they've got a new mission, Paula. They've got a new mission. Catalyze the timely, material, and efficient transformation of the nation's energy system and secure U.S. leadership in clean energy technologies. So what they're saying is they want to transform us, transform our country from a nation that uses oil to a nation that uses something else. Okay, that's not the original charter. And okay. We're spending $29 billion a year for them to do that. And they've been failing at it. They haven't been transforming us at all. They're not even close. Here's one of the statements off of their website. For many, a barrel of oil is almost synonymous with its most prominent product, gasoline. While almost 40% of a barrel of oil is used to produce gasoline, the rest is used to produce a host of products, including jet fuel, plastics, and many industrial chemicals. As the United States, now this is the key, hang on everybody, as the United States works to reduce its dependence on foreign oil, they're not saying here, and increase our dependence on our own oil. No, no, no. As the United States works to reduce its dependence on foreign oil, we must recognize the complexity of that dependence. In other words, oil means more than just driving your car, and work to replace the whole barrel. Well, why do we need to replace oil? Why? It works. It's good. I'm all for all kinds of other energy, but what they're saying is we're going to start reducing our dependence on foreign oil, but we're not going to replace it, not with oil. We're going to replace it with technologies that are not proven and could take another 100 years. The president's speech the other day talked about algae. Holy shamoly, what an absolute joke. Algae? I've been doing some research, Paula. Algae. You're talking like 50 years from now, we might be able to come up with, but you're talking, this is something that nature itself produces, and we're trying to alter it. We are, as humans, are trying to alter the algae to get enough energy out of it to make it even worth doing. And we're not even close to that. So what he's telling us, it goes back to my whole discussion of the cavemen sitting around going, it's so dangerous to go out and hunt with these spears. They're just not that accurate. And, you know, the big game out there. So here's my theory. This would be Obama in the Stone Age. Let's break half of our spears to make things twice as dangerous, and that will push us and force us to come up with a new technology, something like a gun, you know, whatever a gun would be in the future. 15,000 years later, the gun is finally invented. There is no way to predict when these technologies are going to be sustainable. There's none. Zero, because none of them are. They all cost more, 4, 5, 10 times more to sustain than they're capable of sustaining on their own, or that oil is capable of sustaining. So why is it that we have to slit our wrists and bleed ourselves out in the hopes that that will push us to force some kind of technology that doesn't even exist? It's never, ever happened, ever. This guy is so bent on green technology, he doesn't care if he destroys the country and you and I sit in our homes in the middle of winter, freezing our butts off, and in the summertime, hot, hot communities have no air conditioning, electricity. He doesn't care. He's going to force the technology. Well, where's his engineering degree? I have an engineering degree. You can't force technology. It takes time, and it's not here yet. So that's the Department of Energy trying to force technology that it doesn't even have the capability to produce. It's the free market. It's the entrepreneurs out there, not government employees, that have ever produced anything of great significance. Was Bill Gates a government employee? How about Steve Jobs? Was he a government employee? No, absolutely not. Was Thomas Edison, Ben Franklin, government employees? No. So what happens if we reduce foreign oil imports but we don't replace it? And then these things don't come to fruition, which they're not going to. Algae? You've got to be kidding me. I just about fell out of my chair. Algae? Apparently he's given up on solar and wind. Now he's turned to algae because maybe people don't know about algae. Oh, it sounds good. Holy shmoly. All right. So the Department of Energy got a 12% increase in the budget. There were three other departments in the executive branch, Paula, that got increases in the president's proposed budget. None of the other departments got cuts. None of them got cuts. But the Department of Defense is taking cuts, significant cuts. In fact, let me tell you what's going on in the Department of Defense. The first ever enrollment fee for TRICARE for Life, that's military health care system, would take effect in fiscal 2013, which means no sooner than October 1st, 2012. The fee would generate $6.7 billion in revenue over 10 years, according to White House estimates. So we're going to charge veterans and active duty a fee just to have health care. The proposed increases in health care payments by service members, which must be approved by Congress, are part of Pentagon's $487 billion cut in spending. Yep, that mandatory spending cut, which, by the way, the president's going to let ride. But the rest of those spending cuts, the $1.2 trillion, we're just going to raise taxes because we're not going to cut the government. It seeks to save $1.8 billion from the TRICARE medical system in the 2013 budget. So $1.8 billion in just 1 year, and $12.9 billion by 2017. So we're talking just 5 years out. I thought they always did things in 10 years. Oh, now it's just 5 years. Got to rush. We take issue with the Pentagon's decision to raise fees from beneficiaries, relying on them to pay for the budget when it's the department's responsibility to increase efficiencies and cut their own costs, said Kathy Beasley, Healthcare Committee Chairwoman for the Military Coalition, an umbrella group for more than 30 national military associations, of which I'm a member of about five. Some benefits will become means-tested in the manner of a social program, treating military benefits like welfare instead of benefits from military service. Naturally, this is all time to begin next year and avoid upsetting military voters in a presidential election year. Well, God damn it, it's already upset at us. We're not waiting till next year after the election. We're upset. I'm telling you what, the VFW, American Legion, all of my friends, we're on the damn warpath. This has gone too far. I'm sick and tired of this crap. I predicted it several years ago when I was campaigning. I said, it's coming down the road. It's going to happen. This president's going to propose raising costs, out-of-pocket costs, for not only retirees, but for our active duty military and their families. It's despicable. At a time where we're cutting $500 billion, half a trillion dollars, out of the military, Paula, but not one goddamn cut from the executive branch. Not one cut. Not one cut from the executive branch. No, too important. Well, why is it so important? Well, let's just see what the president has to say about serving in the government. We played this before, and I just need to find the – here we go.
Workers like you for the federal, state, and local governments are so important for our vital services, and it frustrates me sometimes when people talk about government jobs as if somehow those are worth less than private sector jobs. I think there's nothing more important than working on behalf of the American people.
Well, there you have it. Nothing more important than being a government employee. Although, you know, a military soldier getting shot at and possibly giving your life, you know, when you guys get hurt, when you military soldiers get hurt, and then we have to pay health care costs for you, no, you're going to have to bear more of that cost. Paula, did you know that not one federal employee under the president's budget, not one federal unionized employee will have their health care costs go up? Not a single one. But all veterans and all military retirees. And when we say military retirees, it doesn't mean that, oh, I served in the military for 2 years and then I got out. No, you served an entire career. You sacrificed 20, 30 years of your life because that's hard stuff to do. But your health care has to go up. Your health care costs have to go up. But we can't cut anything out of the government budget, and let alone the Department of Energy. No, we've got to increase spending in the Department of Energy. My goodness. So you know what it looks like to me, Paula? It looks like to me that the military is funding the increases in the Department of Energy. Because as we go through the budget, the president's budget, and let me come on down here and find the right article here. Here we go. It's a long budget. Under this budget package, gross debt will increase from $14.8 trillion, 98% of GDP at the end of 2011, to $17.5 trillion by the end of 2013, 106% of gross domestic production. By 2022, debt under the president's policies will increase to nearly $26 trillion, remaining above the 100% of GDP. So what's really happening is, in this article, if you go to budget.senate.gov/Republican, you can see the entire article. You can look at the numbers, argue with the numbers, believe the numbers, research them yourself, which I have done. The bottom line is this, Paula. Our annual deficit is not changing. Our debt is continuing to go up, and spending on the government is continuing to go up. But we're going to cut benefits for our veterans and active duty military. I call that despicable, disgraceful, and this is the worst commander-in-chief we have ever had in the history of our nation. All right, I've been talking for a long time. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, you've got your facts right, and again, I've said it before, the reason that we do this, you more so, is that to get the message out there, and this being that the cuts, you know, the cuts of the military, today the leading senators on the budget committee had clashed over whether the Pentagon could even bear, you know, deeper budget cuts. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, who was once chairman of the House Budget Panel, had told senators that while he could find the planned savings of $487 billion over the next 10 years, any more than that would hamper the military's ability to meet future threats. So my question not only to you and to anyone that's listening is that how would that affect national security? Are they not paying attention as to how that would affect national security?
Well, yeah, and look, there's always waste in the defense budget. I know that there always is, and I'm not opposed to that. But what I don't understand, all I understand it is because libtards hate the military. They hate people in the military. Oh, we support the troops. Oh, we support the troops. Why? We're going to make the troops pay more for their own health care. Why? Because health care costs are rising. That's because you sent us to war, idiots. You sent us to war. That's
right.
Why health costs are rising. But we're going to pay for it ourselves. I tell you what, make us pay for our own bullets, too. I mean, that's the problem I have with it. It's just ludicrous. It's stupid. It's despicable. But they don't have a problem with it. And the media doesn't have much of a problem with it.
Well, I think that people ought to make the case known then to the media. They should be writing to their congressmen, to their senators. They should be writing to the newspapers. They should be calling into the radio stations and the television stations and making their point known. There is a large part of citizens in this country that has loved ones and friends that, you know, go overseas to fight for something they believe in, yet the government is not backing them up. That's my opinion. If they're going to cut, or they're saying they're going to cut military and, you know, they're going to cut certain things, I don't understand where the justification is.
No, there are things they're talking about, you know, like the alternate engine. Hey, I wrote an article a couple years ago that got published in the Orlando Sentinel about the F-35 alternate engine. It was wasteful. And I said, no, don't spend the money
on
it. Now the Democrats are saying, oh, look at this kind of stuff. Well, there are plenty of us conservatives who are saying, no, this is wasteful spending. It's pork. Don't do it. I'm all for that. I'm all for that. But to just have a blanket, do you know that there was a proposal when just after the 2010 Congress took over, two proposals from two different congressmen, one congressman, one congresswoman. One was an across-the-board cut of 5%, just 5% off of everything. Everything. Every department, every bit of the government. Oh, it didn't go anywhere. Then there was another proposal, 5.5%. Now, none of these, they all specified no security or military cuts, but everything else, it went nowhere. But what does get traction now? $500 billion out of the military. I mean, the military is the whipping boy for the left. It really is. It's a platform to just despise, to hate the military. I want any libtard out there to please tell me, why is it that the federal government can grow 150% in the last 13 years, but when the military grows 70%, oh, my gosh, we got to stop it. We got to do something about it. Let's go after the vets. Let's go after the active duty military and their families. Let's go after them. Why aren't you going after any of the people working in the federal government? Why aren't you going after the actual bureaucracies in the government that have stifled this economy? Oh, we can't do that. We love the government. That's the problem. The liberals just love the government. They want it to be so big, they will just give everything they have. They will just sell their homes, live on the streets, if the government could just have everything and control everything. Everything. They just can't have enough. Anyway, well, Paula, I'm going to let you take it out here in a moment for us, but we need to talk about something that's important. Our friend, I'm going to put it on the website tomorrow and put some more stuff on Facebook. But Lori and I apologize, Lori, if you're listening. Lori
Foruzenda.
Say it again, Paula.
It's Foruzenda.
Foruzenda, okay. Hey, look, Lori's song is a very important book to be reading right now because it gives you insight into the Middle East. Look at all the problems that are going on over there. She needs some money to get her book republished and out there because it's important. And the deadline is March 14th. There's a website that you can go to. It's called Kickstarter.com, which helps raise money. And she's got $520 pledged at this point, but her goal is $10,000. We really need to help her kickstart this and get it going. And if you go to Facebook, on Facebook, the American Hour Radio Show, you just got to scroll down to where she makes a comment. It's under look for the photo of Obama crying. He's just wiping his face, but we made it. We call crybaby president or whatever. But she's got the link right there. I'm going to repost it on Facebook. I'm going to post it on the website and Twitter it out for the next few days repeatedly. But we need to get people there to donate some money. I know it's a tough time right now. Hey, $5, $10, $1, whatever it is, to help her get that book back out there, because it's a story of an American woman abused and mistreated and what she saw in, I believe it was Iran. I hate to say that. Was it Iran, Paula? I think
yes.
It was Iran.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's Iran. And oh, my gosh, it's an amazing story, and it gives you tremendous insight into that government and the kind of people that they are. Not the people of Iran. The people of Iran. I've met many Iranians over the years. Some of the most wonderful people I've ever known, honestly, Paula. Back when I was in the Navy in San Diego, when I was first there, living in an apartment. We had some Iranian families in the same apartment complex. Man, wonderful people, and I've met some people along the way. You know, I travel all over the place, and I'm always running into people. Wonderful people, wonderful culture, but they have a disgusting, despicable government. And this is gives you insight. Her story, her book, gives you insight into the Iranian government and why it must be overthrown, why it must be stopped. So please, I think if you do a Google for Lori's song, and then if you went to Kickstarter, I know it's kind of tough, but this is, you know, you can always play this back. But if you go to Kickstarter.com, it's too long. It's just too long a link to give you. So just go to the Facebook page and look for it. I'll put it at the top of the Facebook page. In fact, as soon as we're done here, and go to the website, USA Radio. Network.com. Let me just make sure that's right, because I don't go there that often. I mean, I update it all the time. Yeah, it's USAradionetwork.com. Go to my page, Tom Garcia, the American Hour page, and the Paula Zahn page. Go to the American Hour page. We'll have a link there tomorrow at the very top of the page. Let's see what we can do to help her out. And maybe next week we can get her on the show again, Paula, to talk some more about the book and why it's so important for people to find out what the Iranian regime is really about and why we've got to overthrow that government and let the wonderful people of Iran have their country back. So, any case, Paula, that's all I have tonight. You can take us out.
Well, we're going to continue our Honoring the Fallen series, where the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have claimed the lives of more than 450 Americans, bringing the U.S. death toll to more than 6,300 since 2001. Five names that I'm going to be reading from the series: Aaron Joseph Blasio, 25, William Seth Blevins, 21, Alvin Algernon Boatwright, 33, Thomas Andrew Bohall, 25, and Raymond James Border, 31. An individual that I found on militarytimes.com, Army Sergeant Thomas A. Bohall. He was killed May 26, 2011, serving during Operation Enduring Freedom. He was 25 from Bel Air, Kansas. He was assigned to the 4th Battalion, 101st Aviation Regiment, 159th Combat Aviation Brigade, 101st Airborne Division Air Assault, Fort Campbell, Kentucky. He passed away May the 26th in Spin Boldak, Kandahar Province, Afghanistan, of wounds sustained when insurgents attacked his unit with an improvised explosive device. Also killed were 1st Lieutenant John M. Runge, Staff Sergeant Edward D. Mills, Jr., Specialist Adam J. Patton, Sergeant Louis A. Ramos Velasquez, and Staff Sergeant Ergen V. Osman. On a slightly better note, from my adoptive hometown, the Army National Guard members from here in Braintree, from the 1st 182nd Infantry Division, were charged last July with the unique mission of providing security for Provincial Reconstruction Team, FARA. They were divided into three squads known as SEC4 or Security Force, and they were responsible for providing escort and security to PRT members on outside-the-wire missions. I read this week in the newspaper that they will be back home to their families and their loved ones within the next month. So a shout-out goes out to that special unit that's coming back within the month. Your families love and miss you dearly, and they are awaiting your return and safe arrival home, as well as everyone else that is serving overseas. Your families love and miss you dearly, and they're looking forward to having you home real soon as well.
Hoorah. All right. Thanks, Paula. Well, we'll be back tomorrow night to talk more about the Obama deception, the Obama campaign, where it's going, his latest constitutional violations. We didn't have any time to get to that, but I got a few of them lined up. And anything else that's in the news. And hopefully we'll have some good news about Rick Santorum in Michigan and Arizona tomorrow.
Bring
all right, Paula.
Yep.
All right. Thanks. We'll see you tomorrow night.
Bye.
You're listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.